Hi, everybody. I'm Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Jennifer and anyone else involved with my coming here tonight. What a treat. What a treat to be here in Salt Lake, here at the group called NAA Group. And also, I love your format. I love the fact that you are covering all three legacies. I'm a huge fan of these 36 principles, and they are definitely something that I believe in. I think that I know in my journey of recovery that the steps seemed all I needed to, and then it came a time when I knew that I needed to go, for lack of better words, to the next level and to keep myself, my recovery, infused with excitement and enthusiasm, and then which then became very involved with the traditions, although they were part of my original home group. And then moving into the concepts through service. And still today, it's very important that I do the actions to keep my recovery fresh. It's not in a category of, oh yeah, I used to do that and I used to do that, and so now I'm down to this little tiny narrow box of recovery. I've seen what happens and what that looks like, and I don't want that. People have walked that path before me, and so they've shown me what I want to look like and what I don't want to look like, what I want to live like and what I don't want to live like. And I love the way my life is today. It's full, it's fresh, it's active, it's present. And so I just want to thank you for doing what you're doing. And obviously it's attractive to more than just myself, because look at this room full of people here tonight. And that just warms my heart. And I want to welcome Allison. And I hope that you stay here. I hope this will be your last sobriety date, because I know I've had more than one. And I always like to share with you first the three things that have enabled me to keep the same sobriety date during these many years, because with these in place, I know the formula for me of recovery. We have our three legacies, and they are very important to me and something I work very hard to keep at and probably in a current way in my life. And then there's three personal ones, and those are a sobriety date, a home group, and a sponsor. It seems as if when that triangle, a lot of everything else falls in under that, taking the steps, working with others, service commitments, studying our literature. Lots of things fall under that, but it was those three things, when they were firmly put in place, that's when my sobriety really kicked in and has been staying that way. My sobriety date is February the 8th, 1976, which means I've been sober a little over 31 years. It also means I got sober when I was right around 4, okay? Right around there. We start young, we end young. We hit it hard. We don't fool around in the Midwest. I did get sober young, and you'll hear about that in a second, but I've had more than one sobriety date, but this one has stayed, and I believe it's because I've taken the actions our book talks about. I believe strongly in that daily maintenance. And what is that for me? Just a couple of the things is that I start and close my day in the same way, and that's the bookends of prayer. I talk to God throughout the day, but I start and close my day in the same manner. And I choose to start my day on my knees because I need to keep that ego down. I need to remind myself who's in charge and that it is not me. And I'm aware of my physical sobriety. I count my days. I keep a track of my physical sobriety because sometimes I get to thinking that physical sobriety is, well, it's good, but I want more, you know, and I forget what that real basis is all about here. And so I'm reminded of that. Some of the other things that I do in the morning is I ask God, please help me stay sober today. Relieve me of any obsessions I may have, because I don't know about you, but I never have a positive obsession, okay? I mean, I never fret about eating more vegetables or something like that. You know, it's always some resentment or this or that. You know, it's a negative. And when I'm obsessed about something, I'm distracted from service. I'm distracted from usefulness. And so I ask to be relieved of those obsessions and to show me how you want me to be of service. And some days, most days, when I say that, I have a real good spirit about it until the phone starts ringing, you know, and it's inconvenient, and don't they know I'm busy, and hey, don't you know I'm busy, you know, and it's, and you still answer the phone, and that's one of the things I do too, is I answer my phone when it rings. It's not always because I want to, it's because, you know, if I really meant this morning what I said, show me how you want me to be of service, then I need to be aware of the opportunities he creates for me to be of service. And most of my opportunities come through the phone. And so I those are some of the things I do. I don't take that first drink or anything else that affects me from the neck up. One day at a time. For me, my sobriety is very clear, very clean, very black and white. That means for me, I don't drink near beer, okay? I don't smoke near pot. You know, because looking back, I never got near drunk, let me tell you. I was either dry or drunk, one of the two. There was no happy hour girl for a couple of hours in between. When whatever night when it started, it was finished somewhere down the line. But I don't play with my physical sobriety like that. I have not always kept it in safe places. And I am very, very grateful that because of some of the actions I took in early recovery that I did not take a drink. And so I don't try to or want to imply somehow that I got sober and I grew a halo and wings. I've not done recovery perfectly, but I have never chipped on my sobriety date. That, I can tell you, has been 100%. I will not be any poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous throughout my entire time. We are not saints, but I have stayed in these rooms with you. I have never left you. And so I really take good care of my physical sobriety, but I also know that for me, physical sobriety, I thought that's all there was to it, that you just, you know, I got the impression from non-alcoholics, if you just quit drinking, everything's just going to get wonderful. And because it probably did for them. But they don't know that for people like me, it's just the opposite. Things get worse. They don't understand for people like me that drinking is the solution to living and breathing and enjoying life. And the not drinking, I just don't know what to do with it. I got this stuff going on inside that I have no clue what that is. They don't live in my world. And so I had that impression, and when I just did the not drinking part, it's that thing that I term sobriety. You know, not drinking and no program. And so I did the not drinking and I drank again because I didn't know what else to do. I got things going on. I don't know how to explain. I don't know how to talk about it because I don't, and I really don't even want to be here anyway. So drinking was always going to be the easy default for me. And so then I understood that, well, you probably have to go to those meetings too. And so I, you know, did that a little bit, but I got loaded again until I made that final surrender, and that was for this sobriety date. So it begins there. I close my day with thank you, God, for my sobriety. It doesn't matter how dark the day has been. When I end it sober, it was a good day. Because I've learned something that day. I've learned that maybe I could stay sober regardless of what happened to me that day. The highs or the lows, the mediums, the no excitement, lots of excitement, a regular day. I could stay sober through anything. Just today is all I'm doing. And so that's how I believe that I get to keep that sobriety date. But that physical sobriety is the launching pad into a way of life for me. And the other thing that's very important to me is that home group. I have had the privilege to move around in my sobriety. And I've lived in four different, very different areas of the country. That's the reason I've also had four different home groups as I've literally left the state or that part of the state. And what I realized on this last move is I've also had four different last names, okay? So, just kind of worked out that way. They were all legal and legitimate. It just, you know, it wasn't like I got married four times, though, just two times, but, anyway, I started out in Minneapolis, and I went to Atlanta, and I went to Southern California, and now I'm in Northern California. My home group is in Dublin. I live in Concord, and I you know, in my area, they tend to just like 5 minutes is whatever's inconvenient near the 5 minute home base is good, and that's fine. I have no problem with that. But my home group is a 25 minute drive away, which compared to Southern California is like around the corner when I live down there, and so I don't have a problem. I love the getting ready for the meeting, thinking and the meeting, pre-meeting, and then the meeting and the post-meeting, going home in my mind. And so it's an evening for me, and I really enjoy that. But I'll have people in my area say, well, you go from Concord to, I mean, isn't there like something closer by that you could go to? I say, yeah, there's plenty of meetings, but I know every time I go there, I get a solid, great meeting. I'm connected there. It is a great message. And, you know, that's a guarantee for me every single week when I go there. Now, I'm in three minimum a week, usually five and six meetings a week. But this is my home group night. And I'm thinking, you know, I used to drive an hour and a half on the rumor there was a party somewhere, okay? I didn't even need an address. Just over there in that town, let's go, you know, and so driving 25 minutes, hey, not a problem, not a problem. And I love my home group. I've always had a commitment in my home group, no matter what it is. Currently, I'm the, I gave up the donut commitment because they needed me to do something a lot more critical, and so I'm the commitment coordinator there. I've done that before, but I've served my groups in all kinds of capacities to be a part of it. And I just go to the secretary each time and I say, what do you want me to do? How do you want me to be in service? Because I really like it when they pick it for me. Otherwise, I'd always pick something up front, or I'd always pick greeter, you know. And the thing of it is that I'm not going to grow if I do the same thing all the time. And I'm going to deny somebody else the opportunity of what I got to learn from having that job. And so what do you need done? Tell me what you need. And so I love that home group. It's very important to me. In a home group in the beginning, I learned so many valuable things as I continue to. But some of those things were the very first I remember is about courtesy and consideration. You know, I didn't think about anybody but me. That mirror was right in front of my face. I was the only one I was thinking about. And they told me about how important it was to sit down and not get up and rumble around, and how many times I've been so grateful that I didn't do that because, or someone else did it around me, because there were so many one-liners in my life that changed the course of my life. And I cared about you, making sure that you heard whatever it was you needed to hear before I started caring about what I needed to hear. So I started learning how to, lack of a better word, behave in meetings well by thinking about you first. And then it kind of residually, I got the effect from it as well. And I began to listen and to hear the things going on around me. He taught me about having service commitments, being a part of, anonymously in service. I don't need to have the big deal job all the time or the upfront job. How to just get in there and be a part of. You know how to take, Deb. Now let's start giving back. And you showed me how to do that. You showed me how to place principles before personalities. I don't know about your home group, but every home group I've had, there's just been a couple of people that I know would be happier in another home group, you know? You just know these things, you know? And what's always amazing is that, you know, I'm the common denominator here. You know, they didn't live in Minneapolis or Atlanta, or, you know. And so I learned from that the skills that, you know, I get the opportunity to place principles before personalities. They, too, are an alcoholic who's here trying to recover. They're doing the best they can. And I always think, if I'm thinking that about anybody, I don't say it. If I'm thinking that, I bet there's people thinking, wishing I'd go somewhere, you know, to another meeting, too. So, yeah, I'm not everybody's darling. People, you know, have thoughts about all kinds of things. And so I've learned to place principles before personalities. What a great tool that is, and Tradition 12 was talked about tonight. That is the great equalizer for me, is to place principles before personalities, the great equalizer. You taught me how to be a better employee. You taught me how to take responsibility for things. You taught me how to be a better daughter. I am somebody who, I'm an only child, and my parents would divorce when I was 13. They all went their separate ways. My mother moved to California. I stayed with my dad. My drinking really progressed from 12 to 18 when I got sober. I made those amends. And then for the next 14 years, I basically stayed in touch with them a couple times a year. I'd give them a call. We all lived in different states by this time. And a couple times a year, make sure they still had the same phone number, same address, or get up to date. But the relationship was like we've just known each other all of our all of my life. And it wasn't very close at all, and just friendly. And finally, at 14 years, I thought, you know, I think it's important that I develop a relationship with this family. I am their only child. And so I listened to how you repaired your relationships. And you did things like you called them and sent them cards and stuff. And I thought, okay, you've also taught me do what you say you're going to do. Because in every area of my life, I get to be an ambassador of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether they know it or not, I secretly take that thought with me. Whether I'm in the market, on the freeway, in a meeting with my family, I get to be an ambassador. And if I have that attitude with me, I will bump up what I do. Because I don't want to be pointed at and say, God, if that's what AA, what they do in AA or how they behave in AA, I'm not sending my loved one there. And I want them to feel like, wow, that's a safe place to go. That's what I want to carry. And so I listened to what you did, and you said, do what you say you're going to do. So I thought, well, what could I do and be consistent about? And so on the first, in January of 1991, I said, I'm going to call you the first Sunday of every month. And I did that last couple weekends ago, and that was the conclusion of what, I guess, 16 years, and I'll start the next year in January. Now, that doesn't make me wonderful. It just makes me responsible for a commitment I made. It also makes me require a little sticky note that until those calls are made, I don't move it to the next month to remind me. Because my world goes fast. It's busy. It's full. I never wake up thinking, well, I wonder what I should do today. I never have an unscheduled day. It is full of things to do. And I like that. It's not busy work. I feel it's very, you know, useful work. But it moves fast. And so I remind myself how to do those kinds of things. And so you taught me about those kinds of gifts. And that's what a home group has done, because I've listened to your stories and I've heard you share your experience. And that third thing is sponsor. I've had three sponsors in sobriety. Marguerite in Minneapolis is still alive with 43 years. Joe was in Atlanta, and he died with 53 years. And my current sponsor, Millie from Southern California, is 38 years sober. And she and I have been on this path together over 20 years. It'll be 21 years next month. That relationship is very important to me, and it's important that I'm the active participant in it. You know, it's not for her to call me. It's for me to keep her apprised of what's going on in my life on a regular basis. I talk to her at least once a week. I keep her apprised, and it's not that I need to ask her, you know, what shoes do I wear. It's not that kind of a relationship. I can make those kinds of decisions, but living life and emotional things will always be part of being a human being. And I can get just a spinning on something, and I've got, you know, tunnel vision about me. I'm emotionally involved with whatever the outcome is. She is not. She can see things differently than I can. And that value is so incredibly helpful to me. And it guides me on the path of recovery. I have never been guided off this path. It has always been about Alcoholics Anonymous and the tools that we have here. And so I share these things because these have been the difference of why I've stayed sober 31 years a day at a time. Why I do what I do. The examples I have in front of me are amazing. I can only hope that I will be like them. And a sponsor for me, too, if I said one line about a sponsor, would be the people I've asked have been people that I want to be like when I grow up. I was willing to do what they did so I could have what they had. Follow and go where they go. That's why I picked the people that I've had. And so if you are new here tonight, or you're sitting in this meeting restless, irritable, and discontent, and you don't have one or all three of these things in your life in an active state, a sobriety date that's honest, a home group you're an active member in, and a sponsor you actively work with, I invite you to incorporate those into your life. I will guarantee you, if you do, your life will change. I will guarantee you that. Because I have never seen that fail when we have given ourselves to this way of life. Fasten your seatbelts, because it's just about to begin. And what a life it's been for me. But I certainly wasn't shooting for anything like this to be in Salt Lake on a Monday night with a little bit of chilly out there. I was raised in the cold. I was raised in South Dakota. I started there, and I had my first drink when I was 12 years old. I don't come from alcoholism. I'd never seen anyone drunk. I'd never seen a problem drinker, never even heard about it until I saw myself drunk. I'd be the first person I saw drunk. And I'd been invited early in the week by these cool kids in school. And I so wanted to be a part of them because I wasn't necessarily desperate to have a group of friends, but these were the cool kids, and I didn't belong with the smart kids, and I didn't belong with the athletic kids. But these kids were skipping school and smoking cigarettes and drinking beer and looked like they were having some fun. And they invited me, and it was like, oh, this is my debut. You know, I got to really do this up well. And somewhere along the line, I heard them talk about drinking. And so on Friday comes around, and that morning I woke up. And I have all the good intentions that I've had up to that point in my life, which is be a good daughter and a good student, obey the rules. And because I want to do the right thing, and I still want to do the right thing today, but I wanted to do the right thing. And then the second thought on my mind was, I'm going to get drunk tonight. Now, I don't know that those two ideas are going to come in direct conflict with each other. I just heard them talk about drinking, and where I got getting drunk, I don't know where it came from, but my belief was that if I get drunk, I will be definitely accepted by these kids. So we begin drinking that night around 6 o'clock. It's kind of like a liquid potluck, you know, whatever you stole from your parents or the drugstore, and, you know, y'all bringing something to the party. And you know, I don't know quite what to do, so I'm just watching what they do. And there's a brown bag going around. I don't know what's in it, but I know it's alcohol in there. And I'm just getting excited, you know. And so because I want to act like I'm cool and know what's going on, I watch what they did. And so when it got to me, I did what I thought I saw them do, and that was they took a big pull off of that bottle and they gave it to the next guy. And that first drink absolutely ripped out my throat. I mean, just destroyed my throat. But you know, you can always get another throat. You know, just push on. Don't let that stop you. I'm so glad I didn't let it stop me, because let me tell you, a few moments later it went down and it did that first bit of magic. It was quiet, it was warm, it was like hot lava floating in there in my gut, and I was filling in all those holes, and I didn't even know I had any in there. You see, when I took that first drink, I just simply wanted to be accepted by that group of kids. I didn't feel like I'd been dropped off from another planet, couldn't stand being in my own skin, afraid of everything. I just didn't have much of feelings at all as I look back. I went from not many feelings to zero feelings. And I just wanted to be accepted by those kids, and if that wasn't going to happen, oh well. But I was going to give it a shot, my best shot. And when it did that, there wasn't any big kaboomy, but my shoulders relaxed. And there's this warm glow 2 inches behind my belly button, and I'm thinking, you know, oatmeal has never done this for me, you know. I don't know what's in there, but I want some more. And when I first heard that phrase in here, more now, oh man, I totally understood what that meant. I immediately related to that. That bottle went around, and I believe that I'm an alcoholic, not because I drank too much, because, darling, just ask me. I've never had too much to drink, you know, just ask me. I've never had too much to drink, and I didn't drink long enough, as far as I was concerned, if you asked me. But those aren't the qualifiers for being here. There's other qualifiers. It's what it does to people like us. what it does for us on the inside. What happened for me has never, ever happened to my parents. I could have them read the book, explain it by professionals, and they would have an intellectual understanding, but no connection. Just like I don't have a connection to what happens when they drink, which is not what happens when I drink. And when that bottle came around the second time, because I wanted the same feeling, I took the same action. I took a pull off that bottle, gave it to the next guy, and when it ripped out my throat the second time, it wasn't quite as bad. And when it went down, it would change my world. Up here for the second drink, I still felt the anxiety, please accept me. When it went down that second time, that anxiety up here turned into arrogance down here. And on the inside, I just sort of threw my shoulders back and I looked around that room of kids and I thought, hey, aren't they glad I'm here? You know? I know about that almost instant change of perception that happens. Drink number one, please accept me. Drink number two, who needs you? And it was that fast for me. And from that point on, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I woke up, activated, kicked in this illness that we have. Because I activated the mental obsession. I told you how I woke up Friday morning. Good ideals, spot number one. Get drunk, spot number two. Saturday morning, those are in reverse. Thinking about drinking would stay number one for the next 6 years. Good ideals will be eventually removed because you can't drink and do good ideals, and so they go. The other thing that I activated was the physical craving. I don't know that when I take a drink, I just start the cycle of a drunk, that I have it. I do not have the ability to control my drinking. It was a choice as I saw it. I always want to get drunk. I just don't know that I can't stop once I start. I would activate for me some real common behaviors. I would drink as much as I could, as fast as I could, whatever I could, whenever I could. I would black out. I would usually pass out, and now and then I would have the dry heaves, and I had all of that happen that first night. And in my mind, I was able to separate. Now, I know I've never gotten drunk before. I also know I've never had these three things happen before. But my mind was able to disconnect them. These, I guess they just happened, but they had nothing to do with getting drunk. And so right from the very beginning, I'm protecting that drinking. I can't wait to do it again. I wake up Saturday morning. I'm thinking about drinking. Well, how much do I need? Where can I get it? Who can I buy it? I know that Friday night was the very last night in my drinking I ever shared alcohol with anybody. You'll have to get your own. I didn't have any favorites, but I would quickly get them. And a year later, I'm 13 years old, and I'm introduced to the wonderful world of drugs. Because for me, the way I drink at 13 is whiskey out of a bottle with a beer chaser. I don't want to get there tomorrow. I want to get there now. And I find whiskey just happened to be the thing that I like to drink with a beer chaser. I found I blacked out too quickly, and then if I took some accelerations that I could drink longer, stay alert longer, and so I could drink longer, which was the whole point of any adventure, right? And so I found things that would help keep me awake, like speed and acid. And they will. They'll help you get there quicker and in color, you know? And you know, I'm like, sign me up. I'm on board with that one. And I'm 16 and 17 years old, and the last year and a half of my drinking is pretty much daily drinking, and it's whiskey and acid, and that's what I do. That's my diet. And because it accelerated so fast, I didn't think anything odd about that. However, my father did, and I had now been that tornado we talk about, roaring through the lives of others, and all those things had been happening for quite some time. My father tried all human power to relieve me of my alcoholism, and we know in our literature that no human power can. He tried, and if he could have, if human power could have, probably a lot of us would not be sitting in this room tonight. But no human power can. It's far more powerful than anything. But there is one power. And that one is God. May you find him now. And my father sought professional advice. They still said, well, you still have legal custody. You need to commit her. I was 17 and a half years old. I was committed to a treatment center in a town called Grand Forks, North Dakota, for alcoholism and drug addiction. I protested because I thought you should at least be of legal age to buy alcohol before they called you an alcoholic or put you in one of these things. Nobody paid any attention to that, but it still sounds good to me. I still have not had a legal drink of alcohol, and I hope I never do. I would be in this particular four-week program a total of 7 weeks, and while there I would learn a lot about alcoholism. A program called Alcoholics Anonymous, the words sobriety. I had never heard any of those things, and I look back and I think, well, the reason is, why would you seek a solution to a non-existent problem? Now, you know, I was the only one who didn't think it was a problem. But why would I seek out to do something? Because it wasn't a problem to me. It was a solution. I just didn't know it. We would be taken to outside meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my whole point was that I would just do enough, do all the right stuff, so I can manage to get below the radar. They'll start taking their eyes off of me. And then I can just sort of invisibly go back to my lifestyle, which was drinking every day. That's all I really want to do. When I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous things like, your wildest drunken dreams can come true, for several years sober here, I'd think, well, what were those wild drunken dreams, you know? And I realized there weren't any. My world was so tiny. It literally, there was no dreams of career or family or travel or make my mark in the world. Zero. The dreams were the next party from the last party and the drinking in between. The maintenance in between. That, my world was so tiny. And all I wanted to do was go back to drinking every day. That was all I wanted to do. But we would be taken to outside meetings of AA, and so what? I mean, I don't want to look like I'm joining, so I'd sit in the farthest back part of the room I could find and listen now and then to what they were saying, doing exactly what I'm doing tonight, sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other, with that group. The problem was is every now and then I would tune into what they were saying, and I had to find the differences. Of course, they encouraged me to find the similarities, but I'm not that stupid. I know if you find the similarities, then you might be one of those people, and I know I'm not done drinking, so I don't want to find the similarities. But the problem was is when I'm put in an environment of physical abstinence, I begin to hear some things. I begin to have alertness and I begin to have awareness. And if you don't have the problem, you won't recognize anything. You won't connect. And so I would hear things that I would rationalize up here, why my case is different, but down here where I really live, that 2 inches behind my belly button, I'm starting to sort of kind of remotely identify. And I would hear you say things like, I lost my family because of drinking. That's very serious. But my mind said, you can have mine. I don't want them. They're always talking about my drinking. You can have that family. But down here where I really live, it had been necessary for me to leave their home because it was no longer safe for them to come home to. They have an active alcoholic living in their home. I heard you say things like, I used to total out cars. And you know, you did them in drunk drivings, and I know that many of us have a lot of very bizarre drunk driving stories, and I know a lot of, you know, harm has come through that, and so I don't mean to make light of it, but I also was a drunk driver. I was the designated drunken driver of my group. And I could, in my mind, say, well, you know what, I have never totaled out a car officially. Now, you know how we have to be so specific. And I had this little car that started off square. You know how they do. And when you drink and drive like I do, they get rounded out with the drunk bumps, and they've got things kind of askew, and things are missing, and the window had been shot out of it, and my gas cap was a mitten I had stuck in there, okay? And it's like I'm driving a Molotov cocktail round, you know, but it's like I don't think about that till I get sober. And but you look at this, you say, mitten or gas cap? Well, gas caps cost money. Mittens work just fine, you know. And so you just think, you know, we just have some bizarre ways of justifying things. But that's how I did that whole car thing. And then the losing jobs, y'all did. Well, okay, that took a little longer for me to realize because I had some little jobs going on. But I did have quite a few. And the reason was because I maybe I did leave before I was fired. Maybe I did get kind of let go from a couple. And then that last year especially, I had acquired this bad habit of quitting in blackouts. Slight problem when you go to work the next day, you know. It is. Let me just tell you, it's really awkward, okay? Just. And so these are the justifications I had. And then there were a couple things you said that it really bothered me. And you talked about all those broken promises. And I thought, how do they know about those? And I realized that from the time I took my first drink at 12, I hadn't been able to keep a promise because it always included to not drink or take any drugs, and I couldn't do it. I wanted to not get caught, really. But I knew that I couldn't not drink. And the other thing there was a woman who talked about trying to scrub away the smell. And she's talking about booze coming through her pores. And that she's an alcoholic and doesn't drink anymore. And I'm sitting in the back of the room thinking, you know what, I've had this funny odor for about a year. I don't know what it is. I've tried to puff and powder and perfume it away and it doesn't go away. She knows what the smell smells like. You knew that. And my closest that I got to you was, if I'm not careful, I might be one of those people. And so I was sent later on to an all-women's halfway house. I'd be there a total of 9 months. But the first 7 months, I'd followed the rules, which was don't drink, don't take any drugs, and go to one AA meeting a month. Okay? I'm not going to go to two a month and, again, look like I'm interested or joining or something. So I went to that one meeting a month, and to nobody's surprise, I got loaded in California 7 months later on a holiday. I came back and had the attitude, boy, I've learned my lesson. I'm going to step my meetings up now. So I'm doing one meeting a week, you know, and that sounded like a lot of meetings to me when you're still running your own life and just doing that not drinking part. And after 5 weeks, I got a letter in the mail on a Friday. Fridays play quite a part in my life, it seems. I got this letter in the mail, and it had one joint in it. And like any still uncommitted alcoholic, you know, I decided to keep it because I thought, you know, you just never know when you might need something like this. And you know, it's amazing I needed it the next day, you know. And I didn't think about any, you talk about obsession. Boy, I mean, I was focused in my mind on that one joint. And the next day, it was inevitable. I smoked that one joint. That was on the 7th of February, 1976, and I had no idea that that would be the last thing I would take of a mood-altering nature to this moment. It was never my plan. I had no plan. I was just going to smoke that one joint. And I had no idea that that night, that would be for me the catalyst that would create that. We call it different things. We call it desperation, surrender, moment of truth, moment of clarity. It depends. They all mean the same thing to me. Mine, the best description for myself was silent resignation. I just flatlined internally. Physically, I'm 18. You bounce them back pretty good. You can put it back together pretty easily at that time. But emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, there had been no recovery going on, and so it had nowhere else but to sink. And for me, this was just the one thing that finally, those three areas flatlined internally in my life. And I didn't say a prayer, but there was a moment and then a thought that instead of all the objections I always had and the denial and the differences, what came into my mind was, you know what, those people in AA seem to know what to do. And I went to AA the next day to that group I'd been going to once a week. And I went to the long-timers in that meeting and I asked the most important question of my life. What do you do to stay sober? End of question. There was no going to be no debate. I don't really even know what they're going to tell me, but it doesn't matter. My life stinks and I'm running it. I had heard many times, if you're running your own life, you've got an idiot at the helm, and I was proving them right. I was an idiot at the helm of my life, and that wasn't the last time I proved it either. So I asked them that question, and they knew I meant business too. And they said, well, what we do is one day at a time. We don't take the first drink or anything else that affects us from the neck up, and we get a sobriety date. I told you mine. We go to a lot of meetings, and we get a home group. Primary purpose. We get somebody that we can talk to, and that's a sponsor. Her name is Millie. We take these steps, and we get to develop a relationship with the God of our very own understanding. Because as I look at those steps, 12 is my marching orders into carrying the message and to practice what I've learned, these principles in all of my affairs. And that's what I was saying earlier about how, for me, it got to that point later on where I needed to go to that next level of our legacies and to incorporate those in my life and then later on the concepts into my life. And so that became that I got a God of my understanding, which I continue to develop that relationship with. It is very vital to me, very important to me. They said that, you know, those traditions, Deb, those aren't just for the group. Also learn how to practice those in your personal life. And I realized that they were not designed necessarily for personal application like that. But yet when I came here, I had absolutely no tools to interact with other people. By taking those traditions into my life, it is amazing how I'm able to be amongst people and be comfortable the majority of the time, at least act like I'm comfortable and be a part of instead of an isolator, which is so easy for me to do. How to have a relationship with family, another person. And so I've learned how to take those into all of those affairs as well. And we try to be of service and to carry this message. And so that launched me on my path. Those first 4 years, I was very active in Atlanta, in Minneapolis. And just shy of my fourth birthday, I moved to Atlanta. And I got that sponsor locked in, home group locked in, took a four-year birthday cake. And in my mind said, you know what? You know something now. I have no idea what I know, but okay, good. And what I went with is that seven meetings a week is an awful lot of meetings. I think I'm going to trim that down a little bit, get a little balance in my life. Now, I don't have family. I don't have plans for school or service, but I went from seven meetings a week down to two or three. It quickly became two. And what happened is that the insanity and walking into the room called complacency, which you really can't easily see the door of, is what I went into. And for the next 2 years, everything in my AA life began to shrink, 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 shrink. Instead of getting to the meeting, you know, 30 to 45 minutes before the meeting, I'm getting there 5 minutes before the meeting, want a cup of coffee and sit down. Because that's all you have time for in 5 minutes. Instead of being one of the last people to leave my home group, now it's amen, shake, shake, and you're looking at my taillights going out of there. If you could have heard my mind after the second meeting, you'd have probably heard something like, well, got that done for the week. I was treating it like a punch-in, punch-out, take, 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 one more time. And I was wondering why at 6 years of sobriety I am extremely restless, irritable, and discontented. I didn't take a look at my actions. I had another solution, which was people, places, and things are going to make me happy. Now, the real words on that are called men, money, and mansions are going to make me happy, okay? I'm living in Atlanta. I'm going to be looking for Rhett and Tara. Okay, so here we go. And about 3 weeks later, I met a little fella on a Friday night, so it was an automatic omen as far as I was concerned. I meet this little fella, and he had most of the qualifications I was looking for. He even had been sober 13 years, hadn't been to a meeting in three, but no problem, I'm going to help him. So I set out to help this little fella. Of course, he didn't want any of my help. He didn't ask for it, doesn't want it, but I'm going to persevere on this one. And what really happened was the light switch of insanity got flipped on inside of me. And it was just an absolute amazing thank you, God, for giving me the grace, the protection of my sobriety, because I was not, I always went to meetings because I knew, even as goofy and as sick as I was at that time, the minute you make the first excuse, there'll be a little debate, a little guilt. There won't be when you make your second one. And I knew that, and I was terrified of getting drunk. So I always went to the meetings, but boy, again, I was no poster child by any means. After 3 months of this whirlwind romance, of which I was the only one involved in, I hate those kind, you know? This little fella, he got married to somebody else, and so I let him go, and found another little fella, very similar in qualification, did this dance of delusion for 3 months. He walked down the aisle with somebody else, and 6.9 years of sobriety, I came skidding in back to the bases of recovery one more time. Just flatlined emotionally again. But this time there was a lot more at stake, and I knew that I am an alcoholic and there's only two avenues of recovery. Drink, or relief, I should say, drink, which had proven to me didn't work, or return to Alcoholics Anonymous 110%. And my definition of 110% is, I know all the things to do. It's doing all of those, and then you add a little bit more. It's that cushion for these last many years that has kept that comfort within me, that has kept me grounded, that has kept me safe and sane on the inside. It's the and then some that makes the difference, not to you, but to my insides here and my connection. My journey, I would be going to Southern California. I'd get married and move there, and that marriage would come to an end. And I had to take a look at my own part, and I had a lot of parts in that, and that I had a lot of changing to make, because in that marriage all I brought was selfish, self-centered, and self-serving, and those really aren't quality tools to take into a relationship. And I had a lot of changing to do, and I addressed that if God does ever have anybody in store for me to journey this life with, I'd like to have something better to bring to the table. In 8 years, I would meet my husband, Kent, and I met him in April of 2000, and we would get married in April of 2001. He's 19 years sober and a real activist in Alcoholics Anonymous. Pete's met him, and Bill, and some other folks here know Kent, Mike. And, I do like that I'm sober longer than he is, I never mention it unless I need to. We have so much fun together. We're not hooked at the hip, but we journey together really well. It's a grand time. And for our first anniversary, we were back in Atlanta. And this was the last of the people and places important in my life that I wanted him to meet and see. And we're back there on the Friday night. We're at my old home group. It was exciting, thrilling to be back there. Saturday morning, said the prayers, please help me stay sober today, show me how you want me to be of use, keep me of service, and never doubt the power of prayer, because I'm 26 plus years sober at this time. I'm very grounded. I am smack dab in the middle of you guys for these very moments. We would be at a lunch later on that day with friends, and when we sat down, there was pre-poured goblets of wine. And, I assumed the beverage, I confirmed it, I pushed it out of my way, out of my reach. And I don't know why, but I'm not here to analyze it, but what would happen to me is that this kicked off like a six-month physical craving for it to be intoxicated. Now, I don't want to physically be out of it. It's kind of crazy to even, for months I didn't even know how to even talk about it. It's only been in review and retrospect that I've been able to put some words to maybe try to understand or share with you what happened. But it was this physical craving to be drunk. It was almost like a disconnect at the neck. And it was just bizarre, this feeling. And I just figured, like those drunk dreams we get, we wake up and our heart starts slowing down and we realize this is our bedroom and, where we are and who we're with and so forth. And I kept waiting for that wake up to happen. And for the next 6 months, I was just, how could this happen? I mean, I do the 110% for moments like this to just pass, not stay, not land anywhere. What am I doing wrong? I'm obviously, in my mind, doing something wrong if this is staying. And I micro-inventoried myself. I looked at all these things that was going on. It was heavy light, and it just kept circling, and it was baffling, it was frightening. I didn't understand what was going on. Why won't this go away? And after, again, just to synopsize this thing, to after about 6 months, I'm in a meeting one morning. The meeting's over. I'm on my way home. I am gripped, and this wasn't the first time, but gripped with a fear that I would drink against my will, almost like go into a brownout, you know, and just kind of go into automatic mode. And I was so terrified of that. Everything in my life had been active, and it got stepped up another level because I didn't understand what was going on. And I got on the phone with my sponsor. I mean, not implying that was the only time. It was just that day, and I was in tears out of fear. And I told her what was going on, and she said things I had heard before, but it was like they were spotlit. And she said, honey, what we have is the disease of alcoholism, not alcoholism. And you see, for me, I had always figured that if I was doing everything right, I could sort of build that mesh fence, that fine fence, against the thought or and against the craving. And I didn't believe that. How could I have the craving without having ingested alcohol? I didn't smell it. I didn't sniff it. I didn't do anything to activate this. But what I've learned from that is that if I have a progressive illness, which I never denied having, I had better have a progressive recovery. I had better be on my game every day. This is why I find it vitally important that my recovery at 31 years is fresh, is active, is current, is present. I don't want it dusted off. I want it alive. I want it growing. I want it in the middle of you, because I don't ever want another sobriety date. I want to be an example, the best I can be, of what recovery looks like, and that we're never too long sober to have a commitment in our meetings, to be in service, to do the inconvenient things. I'm never too long sober to do what's asked of me to do here. I have a debt to pay back, a life beyond my dreams, a life beyond I could ever believe would be possible. And you know, I recently had gotten this email thing. I don't usually read these, but this one really caught my attention. It was these bunch of favorite quotes people had. It wasn't like big book quotes or anything, but phraseologies, people, one-liners. And one of them I read was that if you were arrested for being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, would there be enough evidence to convict you? And you know what? All I can say is that I hope that every single one in this room can say yes, and for a lifetime sentence. Thanks for having me.